Here on Daf Tzadi Chesamid Beis. Okay, then. If you recall, we learned the Mishnah here on Tzadi Chesamid Beis, and the Mishnah had a Reisha and a Seifa. The Reisha was a case where the Balabayis gave the Uman something to fix, and inadvertently, the Uman, this carpenter, this professional, knocked a nail into the object, and I guess he hit too hard and he destroyed it. And the Mishnah establishes he has to pay for that. Then the Mishnah goes on in the Sefer to describe a case where this Uman was given a Shida, Teva, Umigdal. He was given some sort of a carriage or some sort of a box, a table, some sort of a closet to fix, and the kilkel, and he ruined it. And once again the Mishnah says that he's chayav l'shalom. Amar Rav Asi, we're up to the Gemara. Lo shanu, when the Mishnah says that the Uman is chayav to pay for the lost object, that only applies Ella Shenosan Lechorosh Shida Teva Umigdal Linot Bahen Masmer. The Uman received a full, complete object, but it needed a little bit of fixing, a little bit of a knocking in a nail. And the Uman, instead of fixing the object, he broke the object. And in such a case, since he received a complete utensil, and he broke that utensil, he has to pay for the loss of the utensil. Later on we'll talk about why he has to pay. If he had fixed it and then given it back, then he would be paid for his work. If he fixed it and then broke it, then he would pay for the loss of a fixed utensil. If he never got a chance to fix it, so let's say that utensil, instead of being worth 100, is only worth 90, he'll pay the 90. And that's what the Mishnah says.
At this point, do we have a difference between the first two statements in the Mishnah?
That's what the Gemara is going to be bothered by. What's going to rub us the wrong way is that, according to Rav Asi, there's no justification for the Reisha and the Seifa, because Rav Asi is only willing to hold the carpenter liable to pay damages and compensate the owner only if he had been given a full-fledged utensil. So why did Mishnah have to have two cases? But we're not up to that yet. Mitch will be there in about 5 minutes, I hope, less than 5 minutes. So we're in the middle of Rav Asi. Rav Asi says, Aval, however, Nasan Lecharish Eitzim Lasol Shida Tevo Migdal. If the owner gave or let's say he contracted him for a job to create a utensil from wood, so all he provided the Uman with was only the raw materials, in this case the wood, the Asa Mehen Shida Tevo Migdal. And then, and this is, I think, your case, Alfie, he made a full utensil, but just at the end of the process, Shimron, he knocked in that last nail, you know, the mark of a potage, a little bit too hard, or maybe a lot too hard, and he broke the kli. In such a case, potter, to our surprise, Rav Asi insists that in that scenario, the Uman is potter, he doesn't pay damages. Now, keep in mind, like let's say the wood is worth 10 on the market, and the shida as a complete, perfect utensil is worth 100. So then, obviously, the Uman has to pay the 10. Why does the Uman have to pay the 10? That's clear.
He got the wood.
Yeah, he got the wood. He destroyed the wood of the Balabais. That for sure he has to pay. but he doesn't have to pay the increment, the difference between the 10 and the 100. The other 90 he doesn't have to pay. When does he have to pay the full 100, the 10 plus the 90? That's only if he was given a complete kli that was worth, let's say, 90, and he was asked to fix it and jack it up to be worth 100. In such a case, he has to pay for the entire kli. Its full value, its market value is 100. But that's because he was given a complete kli. But says Rav Asi, if he was only given the raw materials and he was contracted to create a complete kli, then he doesn't have to pay for other than the eitzim, the raw materials, that 10, but the rest he doesn't have to pay. My timer. This seems counterintuitive. Give me an explanation for that. Uman kone b'shvach kli. And last week we had a long discussion, which we won't review now. Maybe we'll review parts of it later on in the shiur when it becomes relevant. But at this point, we only know that the Uman owns Shvach Kli, which means that, let's say, for example, the Kli sells for 100, the raw material is only 10, so the Shvach amounts to 90. And who owns that 90 in the Kli? You know, so you have like a partnership in this Kli. Most of it is owned by the Uman. Rashi says that the only time that the Baal Bayis will acquire ownership and possess this Kli is at the point in which the Uman passes the Kli over to the Baal Bayis. When the Baal Bayis comes to pay him, the Uman makes a trade-off with him, a barter agreement. He says, look, I'm going to give you this Kli, now you pay me my fee. How much is my fee? My fee is 50, whatever it is, right? So I'll give you the kli, right? You invested 10 into this kli, right, to buy the raw materials, the eitzim, and you paid me 50 for my work. You can sell it now in the market at 100. You made a profit of 40. That's not a bad profit margin. But the Uman has a right to say, I'm not going to give you the kli until it becomes a transfer or an acquisition on the money, the fee that you owe me. But up until that point, meaning right before, if I can isolate one frame of time, 1 second of time, that's the second that exactly prior to the handing of the kli over to the Baal Bayis, the kli is still in the hands of the Uman. At that point, the Uman owns the Shvach kli. Mm-hmm. The Eitzim clearly are owned by the Baal Bayis. But the other 90, if that represents the Shvach, is owned by the Uman. And the Uman is going to, you know, hold on to that kli for dear life. He's going to bring it close to his bosom until he gets paid his fee. That's why we explained, I don't know, you weren't here, David, in the other shia, that would have been last Yom Chamishi, we explained that the Uman has the kli as a security. Because let's say, for example, you put work into a project for years, and then you look for the Baal Bayis, Vanari Nenu, and he's nowhere to be found. So you own the kli up until the point that he pays you for it. And then you give him the kli, he pays you the fee, and everybody is happy. But up until that point, who owns the Shvach kli? In effect, the Uman is a partner in this kli, and he owns most of the kli. Again, I'm just giving you a scenario that I'm making up out of my head, that the kli is worth 90 Shvach plus 10 of Eitzim. Mm-hmm. The Uman owns the 90. He's the proud owner of the Shvach. And the nafkamina is going to be, if the Uman breaks this kli, you cannot sue him for damages to compensate the owner at the rate of 10 plus 90, meaning the full 100, because these two elements belong to two different people. And the element of Shvach, which we defined as 90, belongs to the Uman. The Uman doesn't have to pay the Baal Bayis for the Shvach, because the Uman owns the Shvach. And up until the moment that he transfers the kli over to the hands of the Baal Bayis, it's his kli, the Uman's kli.
If the Baal Bayis paid into his pockets.
So it doesn't matter, because that payment would only be what's called schar pa'ula. The only time that payment could turn into... It's also even more complicated, because you may remember that that metaltalin cannot be acquired through most. Do you know about that? You know, it's, even though the Torah accepts kinyan kesef, even with regard to metaltalin, not just karka, but the Rabbanan did away with that for whatever reason, Shema Yomar Nisufu Chitech Baliyah, whatever it is, I don't want to get off on a tangent. But even if I don't go that way, let's assume on a Doraisa level, I can acquire ownership of a Metalton by giving you money for it. But this money was paid as Char Pa'ula. It wasn't paid for the Kli. The Kli is the Dovah Shalom Baliola. You know, at the point at which he was paid, the Uman hasn't yet created the Kli. So what the Balabais needs to do to acquire ownership on this Kli is got to do what's called a Kinyan Agba, Kinyan Yah. And that's going to happen the very moment that the Uman delivers the Kli, the full Kli that he created, into the hands of the Balabais. Up until that point, he, the Uman, is at least a partner in the Kli. When I say a partner, I'm not willing to call him the sole owner. You know, he doesn't have exclusive rights or ownership over the Kli, because the Eitzim certainly belong to the Balabais, and that for sure, if he destroys, he's going to have to he's going to have to compensate the Balabais. But as far as the Shvach is concerned, the increment between 10 and 100, the 90, that he owns. And if he destroyed it, he's basically destroying his own object.
So you instruct the Uman to make something for you, and at the end of the day he's made it, and the Uman then looks at this object he's made and he thinks to himself, wow, this is amazing, I think I'll keep it for myself. The Balabais has got no claim, I'll don't forget it.
Right, so that we discussed last week, that the Uman Kodeh B'Shvach Kli is a conditional ownership. It's an ownership similar, but I wouldn't equate it, to the ownership of a malve over a mashko. Let's say, for example, I borrow 1,000 from you, and I give you an object as collateral, as a guarantee, that's worth 1,000. So you're the malve and I'm the loaf. So you let me and I borrow. Now, you decide, you know what? That mashko is, you know, it's really, really nice. I'd like to abscond with it. I'd like to claim it for my own. That you can't do. So what we have is an ownership with a shiva to it. A shiva is like a lien. It's like strings are attached. It's a conditional limited ownership. The Uman owns the Shvach, but he only owns it in case the object gets destroyed. And if the object gets destroyed, he doesn't have to pay for the loss of the object because that's a product of his creation. Now it's interesting that we're going to soon, Bli Neder, in a few minutes, analyze a question which I'd like you to make note of, so you'll force me not to forget it, to come back to it. There's a halacha that a katan before the age of bar mitzvah, a katana, cannot make a kinyan. That's called cherishot v'katan lav b'nei deyanin. There is one method, again very exceptional, where a katan can acquire ownership, and that's called das acheres makne. That's the old problem of a lulav on the first day, that if you give it to the katan and there's a condition of lachem, then l'chora, what happens is through das acheres makne, the child owns the lulav and he can never give it back to you because he doesn't have the power of being makne lulav. So we have to somehow circumvent that problem. So what I'm going to wonder is, what about Uman Koneh B'Shvach Kli? Let's say if you're a young child, he's very precocious and very capable, and he works as a carpenter and he does amazing work. So I hire this 12-year-old boy to create a kli for me. Would the law of Uman Koneh B'Shvach Kli kick in over here? Why do I have a doubt about it? Because a katan doesn't have the ability to make a kinyan. Right? The kinyan of a katan is not valid. The Torah and Halacha doesn't recognize the validity of such a kinyan. But maybe, if creation is a kli, then a katan, in that sense, in that context, is not inferior to a gadol. Okay, you know what? I'm getting way ahead of myself here. So just remind me that I want to talk about Katan versus vis-a-vis Uman Koneh B'Shvach. Now, Mitch, we come back to your question. Tnan, the Mishnah says, Nosan l'umnin v'kilkulu chayovim l'shalin. The Mishnah says that the Uman has to pay damages. My love, shouldn't we therefore assume, D'yoyev l'hu eitzim, what was given over to this Uman by the contractor, by the Balabais, the Eitzim, the raw materials, nothing more than that. And yet the Mishnah says that if the Uman destroys the Kli, he has to pay for the full value of the Kli. The Mishnah doesn't say that he only pays the value of the Eitzim. It says Chayav. Right? It says Chayavim L'Shalim. What does Chayavim L'Shalim mean? The full market value of the Kli. And yet, all he got was Eitzim. So now, the Uman took Eitzim, he put in all this effort, he created a full Kli, and then he destroyed that Kli. Well, who owns the Kli, according to Rav Asi, up until the point when the Uman gives the Kli over to the Baal Bayis? Who owns the Shvach of the Kli? The Uman. Why should the Uman be paying for the Kli a full 100 when he owns 90 of that 100? Because the difference between the raw material and the final product was 90. Now, whenever you see the words "my love," correct? My love usually indicates what? When the Gemara says, "Isn't this a case of such and such?" What does that mean?
It's not
right. The Gemara is going to reject that. It's only a hava, correct? My love always introduces a hava. So the Gemara answers, "Lo, that's not the case in the Mishnah." But what's the case of the Mishnah? What did the Uman receive from the Baal Bayis? Not Eitzim, but rather Shida Tevo Migdal. And there was a little bit of a break, you know, it had to be fixed. And the Bala Shida contracted a carpenter for a job to fix that Shida. But the Shida itself is worth, let's say, 90 on the market. You know, it's worth a little bit less than it normally would be worth because it needs a little fixing. You need a professional to fix it. But be that as it may, now the Uman destroys that Shida, he's going to have to pay the full 90, the market value of the Shida. In fact, I would go even a step further. Let's say the Uman fixed the Shida and then he broke it. You know, in the last Makush, the Makush Achron, how much would he pay the Baal Bayis? Now 100. Well, the full 100, but no,
90,
I
because he has the shvach, is he?
No, that's what I'm, that's. Oh, no, that's not shvach. That's not shvach, David. Shvach means the creative. Uman kone b'shvach kli means because he created the kli. Here it was a full kli. Now you're right, David. Let's say that the fixing of the kli. I don't want to get off on a tangent. Was such that, let's say, in Hilchas Tumah Vitara, that Kli would not be Makabel Tumah, meaning it doesn't have a shame Kli. You know, it's if the Kli was damaged, even before it got to the hands of the Uman, in a very profound way, such that the Kli is non-functional, and nobody would buy such a Kli on the market, then you're right. That's not our case. That would be Uman Kodeh Bishvach Kli.
Yeah.
We're talking about a case where he got a full-fledged Kli, he's got to embellish the Kli, and fix the Kli, and rectify some default in the Kli. But he's not creating the Kli, and if he's not creating the Kli, there's no Uman Kodeh Bishvach Kli. And therefore, our Mishnah is talking about a case where there is no Uman Kodeh Bishvach, right? So wait, I lost the Lo, Shida Tev. Yeah. So again, to defend Rav Asi, we're going to say that our Mishnah is not the case where the Uman got Eitzim, but rather the Uman received a full-fledged Kli. Oh, now we're ready for Mitch's Kasha. How can you tell me that the Mishnah is talking about a case where he got a full-fledged Kli? Hamidik Tani Sefer Shida Tevo Migdal Michal the Reisha Eitzim. There's no repetition here in the Mishnah. If you're telling me that even in the Reisha he got a Shida and not Eitzim, so what's the difference between the Reisha and the Sefer? The Sefer says explicitly that he received the Shida Tevo Migdal. So now Rabosai, if you can make a note of it, there are two rules of what I call literary rules in learning a Mishnah. When I say literary, I mean we're going to look at the Mishnah as Chas V'Shalom, don't get me wrong, and it's a piece of literature. What I mean is there are certain rules that apply as to how to read a Mishnah. Those rules are based on the fact, usually, that Rebbe, when he authored the Mishnah, wanted to be as concise and abridged as he possibly could. Why was Rebbe so interested in being abridged? Correct, because it's only Eis Lasos. You know, if not Eis Lasos, you're not allowed to write the Mishnah. So Rebbe wanted to create a Mishnah that would force us to depend upon Torah Sheba'al Peh. In a sense, the Mishnah is not a self-contained unit, because that would really be a full-fledged violation of replacing Torah Sheba'al Peh with Torah Shebichsav, and that Rebbe didn't want to do. So Rebbe wanted to make sure that we would have to come on to interpretation. So anyway, getting back to our sugya, so there are two rules here, and we're not sure which one to apply. One rule is called Pirushe Kamafarish, I'll explain that, and the other rule is called Ketzad. What's the difference between the two? Now, the rule of Ketzad tells me that if you would have been left to your druthers, you would have come to the wrong interpretation of the Mishnah. And therefore the Sefer is coming as a Ketzad. Ketzad means add the word Ketzad and wedge it between the Reisha and the Sefer. Mm-hmm. And the Reisha you mistakenly thought was talking about case X. The Sefer comes to tell you, straighten you out, no, it's not case X. The scenario is not X, but rather the scenario is Y. And the Gemara now is going to go through these two operating rules and see how they apply to our mission, see what we come up with. So the Gemara says, Amri Perushe Komefarishle. Ketzad. Oh, I'm sorry, my mistake. The Gemara now combines Perushe Komefarishle with Ketzad. So cross out what I told you. It'll become more precise in just a minute. Perushe Komefarishle Ketzad. Meaning, let's add the word Ketzad and wedge it between the Reisha and the Sefer. In other words, what was the case of the Reisha? What did the Uman receive from the Balabayas? Ketzad. He's Nosan Lumel Sakein, the Kilkul Chayv L'Sham Kigon, Shenosan L'Chora Shido Tevo Migda. So really, there's no Reisha and Sefer. The Sefer is just an elucidation of the Reisha.
What's the point of having it?
Oh, so let's hang on just a minute. V'hachi nami mistavra, and it's very logical to assume that the Mishnah should be interpreted based on the modus, based on this rule, the mechanics of Ketzad, the Ketzad Ketani. De'isal kedaitach reisha eitzim. If the reisha would have been a case of wood, as you thought, and that would be an attack and a problem for Avasi, is hashtash mean an eitzim chayom l'shan v'lo amrinon uman kona b'shvach kelim is shida tevu umigdal mi boy? If you're telling me that even if the uman was the agent to create this kli, it was through his work, he only received eitzim in the reisha, nevertheless he's chayov because we don't maintain the principle of uman kona b'shvach kli, then it goes without saying that if he received a full-fledged Shida Tevu Migdal and he destroyed it, he's chayv for that. Notice the big chiddush here is that even though he, the Uman, created this kli, he's still chayv to pay for the entire value of the kli. Once you've told me that, there's no need for you to tell me Shida Tevu Migdal. So according to your Hava Mina, that there's a Reisha in case X and a Seif in case Y, the Reisha is talking about Eitzim and the Seif about Shida Tevu Migdal, then why didn't the Mishnah just simply drop the ball, leave out the Sefer of Shida Tevu Migdal, and I would have understood that if the Uman is Chayev for Eitzim when he created the Kli, then for sure he's Chayev for destroying a full-fledged Kli. And why would Rebbe add a Sefer which is totally superfluous and unnecessary? But the answer is Ketzad, that if I put the Ketzad in, then the point that Rebbe is trying to make is that you're not going to be chayev. The Uman is not going to be chayev if he got Eitzim. The Uman is only going to be chayev Ketzad if he got a Shida Tevo Migdal. Says the Gemara, you're telling me, Ochinami Mistavra, your logic is based on this Kal V'chomer in which the Sefer becomes totally superfluous. Ibishum Holo Iria. In other words, that's not a convincing proof. Why? Because I would apply a different principle. This is the second principle that I wanted to suggest before. And that's called Tana Seifa Ligluye Reisha. Which means sometimes when we learn a Reisha and a Seifa, we don't put in the word Ketzad. We don't say that the Seifa is coming to interpret the Reisha. But on the contrary, the Seifa is coming to tell you that the Reisha is different from the Seifa. And the Reisha is talking about a different scenario. That's called Tana Reisha, Tana Seifa, Ligluye Reisha, to shed a light on the Reisha. Shalo Tomar, don't misinterpret that the Reisha is a case of Shida Tevo Migdal, that what the Uman received was a complete product. Avol Eitzim Lo, but if he had received only the raw materials and he created the Kli, then he was Kona the Shvach and he doesn't have to pay. Is Tana Seifa Shida Tevu Migdal Michlal de Reisha Eitzim Bafilochi Chayv L'Shalem? The Gemara says that there's an equal attraction to apply a different mechanical rule and a principle in interpreting the Mishnah, and that is Tana Seifa Legluye Reisha, which means that the Seifa is different than the Reisha, and that's called contrast. So again, Rabbi, so let's try to understand why the Mishnah needed both the Reisha and the Seifa. And there are two possible approaches, two alternative approaches to answer that question. Why the Mishnah needed the Reisha and the Seifa? There's going to be Rav Asi's approach, and then there's going to be the Bar Plukta of Rav Asi's approach, the one who rejects Rav Asi. The one who rejects Rav Asi is going to apply the principle of Tana Seifa Ligluye Reisha, that the reason why Rebbe felt compelled to add a Seifa, and he couldn't leave it alone with the Reisha and drop the ball there, is because Rebbe wanted to make sure, not, you know, make it crystal clear that the Reisha doesn't suffer any misinterpretations. Don't tell me that the Reisha is talking about a case of Shita Tevu Migdal, right, which would be Rav Asi's approach. No, the Bar Plukta Rav Asi is yelling and screaming that the reason for the Seifa is to make sure, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that you understand that in the Reisha he got what? Eitzim. Had Rebbe sufficed, if there's such a verb, I don't know if I'm creating a new verb, had it been sufficient in the mind of Rebbe to write the Reisha, then we have a Talmud in the audience who insists that, you know, I have the right shot in what Rebbe had in mind. What Rebbe had in mind is, obviously because Uman Konim Shakli, is that the Uman received the Shita Tevu Migdal. And Rebbe went out of his way, Lafuki, to exclude that Talmud Toa, who's making a mistake, Ayin Baba Kamadav Beis Amid Beis, where the Gemara has this whole thing about why the Tana has to come again, you know, Lafuki, a Talmud Toa, you know, a Toa who makes a mistake. But there's a valid possibility and a statistical probability that there will be some Talmidim or one Talmud out there who's going to make a mistake and say that the Reisha, since it wasn't clear from a literary perspective, should be clarified from a conceptual perspective as referring to a Shita Tevu Migdal. Because if it was Eitzim, there's no reason why the human should pay. Comes along Rebbe and he adds the Seifa in order to clarify that the Reisha, by contrast, is talking about a case where the human received Eitzim, and this means Ein Uman Kodem Bishvakli. That's one valid approach. The other approach is going to be that there's something called Pirushi Kamafarish, meaning add the word Ketzad. Why did the Mishnah write a Reisha and a Seifa? The Mishnah wanted to tell you that there's a Talmud in the audience that mistakenly thinks that the Reisha is talking about a case of Eitzim. Comes along Rebbe and he says, don't think that we're talking in the Reisha about a case of Eitzim. Ketzad, what's the case of the Mishnah? It's Shita Tevu Migdal. Go ahead, Mitch, what do you want to say?
No, I still don't see if with that approach, well, you need both.
Which was the second approach or the first approach? Ah, because if you only had the Reisha, then somebody's going to tell me that it must be logically that the Reisha is talking about a case where he got Eitzim. And even though he created the Kli, he has to pay for that Kli, because one split second before he destroyed the Kli was worth 100. Let him pay for destroying a Kli worth 100. And don't give me any hogwash about Uman Kodem Shach Keli. I'm not on board with that. Council of Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, and he says to that Talmud, name Ketzad. What's the case of the Reisha? The case is Shita Tevu.
So say the Reisha.
That's what it is. As soon as you add the word Ketzad, that's
right,
what it
but
is.
But just say it.
Why don't you just say it in the Reisha?
Just say it in the Reisha. If the Reisha says Shita Tevu, there'd be no question.
Because then the Talmud Torah is going to say that Lav Dafka, that Rebbe wasn't limited to Shita Tevu Migdal, he would apply even in the case of Eitzim. In other words, what Rebbe wanted to do was tell you that you have this ambiguous Reisha, and there's somebody out there is going to say that he got Eitzim. Nein, Rebbe says Ketzad, only in this case. Ketzad is like saying the Reisha should be understood exclusively as a case of Shita Tevu Migdal. That's the emphasis. Okay, Rabbosai, Lema de Messiah. Let's bring perhaps a support to Rav Asi. Okay. we're about to learn Rav Osei's sugya, which on a certain level of pshat is very problematic, very difficult. I hope you'll agree with me. But on a level of like a jump off, so to speak, to a world of Torah analysis, it's one of the most beautiful sugyas I've ever seen. So let's go through first the level of pshat, and then we'll see how it's a jump off, a springboard to some very deep and profound analysis. Lema misayele, let's bring a Mishnah. This is the next Mishnah that we're going to learn as a support text for Avas. Hanosein semer letzavo. Okay, we should really bring out a band here because we're about to get to Daf Tzadi Tes. How long have we been on Tzadi Ches? I think for a good couple of months. Okay. So what happened so far before we get to Daf Tzadi Tes Omer Aleph? There's something called a tzava, and what you do is you give him wool, and by a process of boiling dye together with this raw wool in a pot, okay, that's called a yore, which we'll see here on Daf Tzadi Tes. The dye, which is in a raw form called samamonim, it's sort of some sort of herbs, they exude, is there such an English word? Exude their color, and that color gets absorbed in a slow process into the wool. And dyed wool is worth a lot more than raw wool. That's what we know so far. So this dyer was contracted to take wool and do this whole process of dyeing, in which he would create a dyed wool, which is worth a lot more than just raw wool. But what did he do? Higdicho yore. He raised the flame of the fire under this pot a little bit too high, or maybe a lot too high. And as a result, the tzemer got burnt. I don't know if it got burnt literally, but it changes colors to a burnt kind of color. You know, it's brown and it's fashtunken and nobody's going to buy it. It's basically worthless. Now, you know, if your wife did this for your dinner one night, you know, that's called Higdicho Tavshilo. I'm not sure if that's grounds for divorce, you know. We wouldn't. But in this case of a dyer, it's certainly grounds for divorce. You know, this is not the kind of guy that you want to hire and contract to be your dyer. Because basically, if you pardon the pun, the wool has been dyed, has been made to be dead. Anyway, the Mishnah says, No se lo dmei Samro. What's the diuk here? Samro seems to indicate that he's paying him the value of the wool. When I say the wool, I mean what wool? The dyed wool or the raw wool? The raw wool. Again, that's what the Gemara is going to assume at this point. And if the Mishnah means that he pays him the value of the raw wool, then demate samro in demate samro ushvach olo. He's not paying the value of dyed wool.
What's the shvach? Negative shvach, is it?
Well, he done it correctly.
So, well, it's more than that, Daniel. I mean, maybe this is what you have in mind. There's time T1, time T2, and time T3. That's how the Gemara understands it. Soon we're going to reject this. Time T1 is the moment in which the dyer received raw wool. Time T3 is the moment where the wool went up in smoke, if you pardon that phrase. Time T2 is the moment in which the wool absorbed the dye and it's worth 100 on the market. It's a beautiful dye.
There is no...
No, because...
Practically, there is no such time because...
There isn't?
Well, I mean...
I thought there definitely is. The Gemara is going to agree with you. I thought for sure if you turn a fire on...
It's meaningless to say that in this case.
Well, yes and no, Michael. It's meaningless after you get to time T3, but at time T2 you have a shita tevo migna. You've got a complete dyed wool that's worth 100. Again, it might be for a fleeting second, but nevertheless, there was a moment in time in which it was worth that. Now, what the Tzabai did was, instead of shutting the fire down, he raises the fire, or he leaves the fire, whatever he does, for that extra second, and poof, it all goes up in smoke. And therefore, if you leave out the halacha of Uman Kona Bishvach Kli, if you bracket it for a minute, right, and you hold like the Bar Plugta of Ravasi, the phantom Bar Plugta, which we're going to soon identify as Shmuel, then the Mishnah makes a lot of sense. What does the Mishnah say? No, I'm sorry. If you maintain that ein uman konishas, then I have a kasha. Because if ein uman konavishvach kli, then the uman destroyed what?
A good dyed wool.
And he should be paying 100. Yet the Mishnah, the way the Gemara interprets it, says that he's only billed for the value of the virgin wool, which is 10 and not 100. Says the Gemara, the only way I could justify this Mishnah, lav sheik dicho liachar nefila, meaning after the wool was placed into the yoreh, and we have to add another few words, and absorbed the tseva, afterwards higdicho, it became fashimult and fardarmin, right? So if that be the case, the ika shvacha, there was one moment of shvach, and yet he only pays for the raw material, for the tseva. Shmamina, the only way of justifying this Mishnah is uman kone b'shvach kli. Now, why does the Gemara insist that we're talking about a case where there was that moment of shvach? How does Gemara know that? Like Michael said before, maybe there is no such moment. Maybe it got destroyed as soon as it fell into the pot. So the answer is, this is called Stimas Lashon HaTana, Stimas Lashon HaMishnah. That's another rule, a literary rule. Meaning, if the Mishnah doesn't qualify, then that's what it is, it's unqualified. In other words, there are two different scenarios. Again, it all depends on how high the flame is, I guess. But there's one scenario in which you just simply, the flame was at the right, controlled, you know, they now have ovens, I think, that have a controlled button to it, you know, it's like they're, you know, the oven thinks for itself. You know, it decides. What is it? Automated. Yeah, autopilot kind of thing. So that's one way of understanding it. And the other way of understanding it is that no, the fire was so hot and so intense from the beginning that it never even went through a stage of shvach. So the Gemara says, "Stimas lashon haMishnah." If the Mishnah didn't qualify, it means the Mishnah is talking about all cases. Even the case where there was a shvach.
What I still don't understand is the bow of the wool has only lost out the cost of the wool. Why should he get more than that?
Because at one moment in time he had 100 in his pocket. Again, he hasn't yet marketed it, that I grant you, but he's got an object that's worth 100.
He didn't have anything in his pocket at any time.
Oh, you mean if you hold uman kone b'shvach kli? Wait a second. Wait, don't confuse me now, Michael. Wait, right now we're holding ein uman kone b'shvach kli, which means that the owner of this wool is the owner of the wool. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yes.
That sounded a little bit, you know, that was the tautology. But what do I mean? What I'm saying is that when I hire a professional, as the value, the market value increments,
right,
at every second of the way, I own that raw material.
I hear that.
So that at one second in time, if you hold Eidum and Kodesh Shakli, I'm the proud owner of what? Of Tsemer Tzavua, which is worth 100. For example, I'll give you an example. Let's say, Michael, a person would fly in from the heaven, fly down from the heavens, shut the fire off, grab the wool, and run for his money. What do you call such a person? A Goslin. How much would he pay? He would pay the full 100.
I accept that.
Okay, if you hold Ein Uman Kone B'Shvach Kli. So why is it that the Mishnah, in an unqualified way, says that he always pays for that, that the Uman will always, in all scenarios, pay for Tzemer and only Tzemer? Why? And the answer is because Uman Kone B'Shvach Kli. Because any increment accrues at this point in time to the Uman. And if he destroys it afterwards, he only destroyed his own Shvach, because Uman Kone B'Shvach Kli. Omar Shmuel, I'm willing to tell you that this Mishnah should not be unqualified, but rather should be qualified. Kigon Shekdicho B'Shas Nefila Deleka Shvacha. So Rabbo, say what position in the controversy over Uman Kone B'Shvach Kli or the opposite is Shmuel taking? What is he holding? Why does he have this agenda to circumscript the Mishnah? I mean, I'm taking it down and make it into
circumvent.
not circumvent, but to circumscribe, I don't know what word you want to use, to limit the Mishnah, to qualify the Mishnah. What agenda does he have?
Wants to think it could be like Ravasi.
No, he is maintaining against Ravasi, meaning that Shmuel now becomes that phantom anonymous.
Oh, Shmuel, but that's his cheetah. I mean,
I'm just saying, we didn't know who is the Bar Plugta Ravasi. Now Shmuel emerges as I'm the one. Right? I'm the one.
Right. But I thought he was saying that it could be like that. So if it could be like that, then it's...
No, but why is he saying Hachamai Eskinen? Like, you know, he's saying, I'm going to qualify the Mishnah. The reason is he has an agenda here, because he holds that Ein Uman Kona Mishvachli. And if Ein Uman Kona Mishvachli, why is the Mishnah billing the Uman for 10 and not for 100? You know, for wool as a raw material and not for dyed wool? The answer is because Ein Uman Kona Mishvachli. And if Einu and Kodem Mishvach Kli, then how can the Mishnah say he only pays for raw wool? The answer is because the wool went into the Ora and completely, immediately was destroyed.
It was never any
Shvach. The Lekka Shvach.
So there's difference between the two cases. In the case of the box of the carpenter, there was a moment of Shvach.
Correct.
And in the case of the wool, there wasn't.
Correct. So in the case where, let's say, for example, the Uman received Eitzim, and he made it into a sheet, and then a second later he broke it. He's going to pay, according to Shmuel, the full value of that Shida, which is the 100. Yeah. Why? Because Ein Uman Kona Mishvachli. Here too, if there was a gradual process in which the wool was destroyed over a period of time, but first the wool absorbed the dye, and it was worth 100 on the market, the Uman is going to pay the full 100.
Right, but it didn't.
But that didn't happen. Says Shmuel, that's not the case in the Mishnah. The case in the Mishnah is where the fire was so intense that the very second the wool hit the pot, destroyed. It went up in pot. The Gemara's not happy about that. Why? Because the Gemara thinks that the halacha is like Ravasi, that Uman Kona Mishvachli. The Gemara even tries to prove and substantiate Ravasi, and even if the Gemara doesn't succeed, it still has vested interest in finding a proof text for Ravasi, Uman Kona Mishvachli. Shmuel, however, has a tremendous power in Didi Mominus, because we always paskin like Shmuel in Didi Mominus. So the Gemara is up in arms here. Aval higdicho liachin afila mai nosin lo dmei tzamro v'shvilcho lema Shmuel lesli d'Ravasi. We're in a bind over here, because if Shmuel is qualifying the Mishnah as referring to a case where it immediately got destroyed when it hit the pot, but had it been gradually created as a dye, then the Mishnah would say he has to pay, the Uman has to pay, the Tzaba has to pay the entire value of the dyed wool, because Ein Uman Kona Mishvachli, then we're going to have to paskin Ein Uman Kona Mishvachli. And the Gemara would really, really like to avoid that, because at the end of the day, we're going to paskin like Ravasi Uman Kona Mishvachli. Amar lecha Shmuel, so Shmuel says, Hocha b'mayaskinon, don't think that just because I said what I said that I maintain that Ein Uman Kona Mishvachli. No, I happen to be on board with Ravasi that Uman Kona Mishvachli. But what was the case of the Mishnah? Kigon de Semer Visabimonim de Balabayis. That it wasn't the Uman who owns the Samamonim. The Samamonim are the dyes. I mean, clearly the Balabais owns what? That's without a doubt, the wool. But who owns the dye? We would have thought that's, you know, you pay an Uman, you know, he supplies the dye. But Shmuel says, no, that's not what usually happens. The Uman is there just to boil the Samamonim and the Tzemer. The Samamonim and the Tzemer are presented to the Uman in normal cases by the Balabais. So both the wool and the dye belongs to the Balabais. And in such a case, Agar Yodei Hu Deshakil, which means that the Tzaba was not contracted to create a finished product. I mean, basically, all the elements in that finished product belong to the Baal Bayis, whether it's the wool or the dye. He's only being paid to go through the tircha of boiling the wool and the dye in the same pot.
So that is to create the finished product.
What do you say?
That is to create the finished product.
Right, but the Gemara thinks that there are two different ways of contracting a professional. One way of contracting a professional is basically to give him the barest. In other words, let me try to give you the Rashba's interpretation of this Gemara. What happens between raw material and final product? Is there a long, tedious process? Oh. So the Rashba claims that there are two different answers to that question. In some situations, the professional that's being contracted is doing a tremendous amount of work. Meaning, if you look at the raw material and now look at the final product and ask yourself, how did it get there from here to here? The answer is that there was a tremendous amount of professional skills. This guy had to go to carpentry school, he apprenticed, and after 10 years, I'm just dramatizing it, he got his diploma. And he's very creative. He's very useful with his hands. In such a case, I contract him as what's called an uman kablon. Those two words are synonymous for our purposes, which means I pay him for the final product. I don't care how long it takes him. I don't care what efforts he puts into it. He creates something, and I'm going to pay him for that creation. That creation doesn't look, smell, or sound like the original raw materials that I gave him. However, there's something other than an uman kablon, who's paid for the final product. There's something called a poel, we'll explain that, who's paid for his schar pa'ula. What that means is that there's no major difference here, or no major creative input here, on the part of the professional. You and I could have done it. Just say, we don't want to set up a shop for this. So what we do is, here, my friend, here's the wool, here's the dye, the samamonin, put it together in a pot, turn on the fire, and make sure that you turn off the fire at the moment of maturity, not to leave it there for too long. In such a case, says the Rashba, I'm just presenting the Rashba's understanding of the sugya, you're not hiring an uman, you're hiring a poel. A poel means you're assessing how much physical labor he puts in, how much time he puts in, and it's all very limited, and that's what you're paying him.
He never requires anything.
Says the Rashba, what's the nafkamina? Nafkamina is going to be whether kone b'shvach kli or not. If it's an uman, if it's a person who is a professional and he's very creative and voila, yesh me'ayin and abracadabra, what I gave him was a couple of planks of wood, that you would normally put into your fire to use it as firewood. And all of a sudden what I see in front of me is a carriage, it's like a Rolls Royce kind of thing in that time, and I can sell it for a home to a phone. That's called uman kone b'shvach kli. I mean, after all, the uman put in a tremendous amount of effort, and he was the creator of this object. Masha Einkein, in the case of a poel is just a laborer. He never went to school, or maybe he went for a month, crash course, and he doesn't have a diploma. I can basically provide him with everything. He throws it into a pot, and he's got to use a little bit of seichel yosher, abyssal seichel haver, and he knows how to turn on a fire, and he knows when to turn off the fire, for God's sake.
You're reading all this in to the fact, what we're dealing with raw material and skilled work. So here, the raw material, we say, the tzemach belongs to the Baal Bayis, the dye belongs to the uman, and since it belongs to the uman, therefore he's no longer acting as a poet.
Right, you said it right. He's no longer acting as a poet. That's the big question on the Rashba. But wait a second. What I need is for you to empathize with the Rashba. I'll tell you, what do I mean? No, this is a derech halimud, and I find this, I always have this problem with teaching Torah, that people automatically attack a chidush, and what they skip is, and that's important not to skip this step, is what I call the empathetic step. What I mean by the empathetic skep is, let's understand where the Rashba is coming from. The Rashba has a tremendous kasha, and Alfie, if you have a better answer than him, I'm very eager to hear it. What's his kasha? We just finished saying that if the Uman received wood and he created a shida, then we apply the principle of Uman Kodem Shvach Kli, he'll only pay the 10 of the Eitzim, because if he destroyed this shida, it's his shida. On the other hand, we just finished saying that if the Balabais owns wool and he owns Tzemer, I'm sorry, and he owns Sabamonim, which are the two raw materials paralleling in the case of Shida to what? To the wood. Yeah. Okay, it's not one, it's two, but come on, you know, you can't tell me that two is twice as much as one, and therefore that should change it. Right. All of a sudden, Shmuel says, we drop the ball on Uman Kodem Shvach Kli, and the Uman, if he destroys this dyed wool, in that case, is going to pay for the full 100. What happened to Uman Kodem Shvach Kli? Just because he gave him not only the wool, but he gave him the dye? So the Rashba racked his brains to try to come up with some explanation. Comes along Alfie and he asks the kasha on the Rashba. That's a very good kasha. What happens if the Uman, in this case the Tzaba, he owns the dyes? Is Vasis Geshen? What happened to him? All of a sudden, the Uman became this tremendously creative, you know, Uman. And if the Rashba is measuring Uman Kodem Shvach Kli by the standards of creativity, what is going on over here? What's more creative? Who cares? Who owns the Salamon, right? What difference does it make? You own the Salamon. And what would the Rashba say if a third party owned the Salamon? Like, what difference does it make? You know, if the Rashba wants to tell me that a Tzaboi doesn't go to Tzaboi school because all he does is turn on the fire, whereas an Uman, in the case of a carpenter, you know, he was apprenticing as a carpenter for the last 3-5 years, Nicha, that I can understand. But to tell me that it all boils... I should use the word boil here. But it all depends upon who owns the stupid sum of money. Yeah. You know, in the bank account, who owns the sum of money? Like, my high. That I don't understand. But Rabosai, as difficult as this sugya is on a level of pshat, that is really difficult, it is a springboard for a beautiful, what I call, conceptual analysis. Now, I have here in the back of my Masifta, you know, I'm a big fan of Masifta, something called Yalkut Bi'ud, which I rarely have the luxury of looking into. I just simply don't have the time. Maybe that's my fault. But now, he starts with the following sugya. You want to listen carefully? This is absolutely stunning, and I don't know what we can finish in the next 7 minutes, but I'm going to try with your rishus to do whatever we can. Okay. A Baal, unfortunately, decided to divorce his wife. Okay, he has to commission whom?
The sofer,
to write a get. Now watch this. Don't answer the following question for the meantime. Who owns the cloth and who owns the deal? Leave that on the side for just a minute, because I just want to gradually bring us into the suit. Okay? The scribe writes the get. And if the scribe writes the get, then the final product is a result of his creative act of writing a get. I'm not going into the Rashba's business about, you know, is it Scharpula, is it an Uman, he was professional, leave all that out. Okay. There's only one problem. And that is that the get has to be owned by whom? Wow. By the Baal. If the Baal doesn't own the get, forget it, finito, it's not going to be a gerush. So the basic problem that the Achronim want to face is, in light of Uman Kodem Shvach Kli, do we have to assume that in every case of a get, the scribe actually has to be makne the get, he has to transfer ownership over the get to the Baal? Nechleku Achronim Badovar. He says the following. If I maintain that the sofer, like any uman, is kona shvach haget al yedei ksivaso, then he says gam im hadyo eno shelo. Let's say the dyo belongs to the Baal. Okay, in the following case, right? That's one case. Is then lefirav asi she'uman kone b'shvach kli? Then perhaps we should say that the dyo is similar to the case of etzim. Okay, hold your horses here. And since the sheet of Ravasi, and we accept Ravasi, is that uman kone b'shvach kli, that means that the uman now took the dyo, or the etzim, if you will, of the baal, and he created the get. He owns the get, and therefore he owns the get. So what's so terrible to say he owns the get?
Everything's terrible.
No. Are you willing to hold your horse, hold your chair for this one? This is the beauty of Torah. I'm going to start crying. I get so emotional about it. The Gemara says that a cotton can write a get. That's called Gadol Omed Al Gabo. Now watch this. A katan can make a kinyan and be kona something, but he doesn't have the possibility of being makna something. And the Gemara tells us, now follow A and B. A is uman kona b'shvach kli, and we're assuming it applies even to the case, according to this school of thought, of a get. The Gemara says B, a katan could write a get. Therefore C, who owns the get? A katan owns the get. So how the heck can a katan write a get? He can't be mocked to the get back to the Gadol. And you're taking a sugyan shas and you're simply ripping it out of the Talmud. What a beautiful kash. And whatever the answer is, it won't give me as much pleasure as the kash itself. That I promise. The kash itself is mamish me'ein olam haba. If you assume that uman kona b'shvach kli applies like in the case of Eitzim, to the case of a sofer writes a get, even if the dyo, I grant you, is owned by the baal, because the creation here was that of the sofer, then how are you going to justify that a cotton can write a get?
Sister's the son of the baal.
What, and he dies and he yashed him? What's the case?
The son of the Gabal is going to be a get that's going to be written afterwards, and the cotton is coded for his.
Well, that's only in the case of a katana, not in the case of a cotton. The cotton has its own independent ownership, you know. What's it called? Binurea Besavia, that she.
More than the cotton could write a get. What was the.
There's a takana mitzias cotton goes to the farm. That's what you can. But now we're not talking about mitzias.
There's a fact that cotton can write again, whatever the sugya is.
Yeah.
What was the shakir? What was happening in the yes?
I don't know. I can just tell you that there's no question that a cotton can write again. You need Gadol Omed Al Gabo for a different reason. Anybody know why? That's called lishma. Because whenever you need lishma, you always need a Gadol Omed Al Gabo. The child is not capable of having lishma. So with mitzari, if the lishma of the Gadol Omed Al Gabo. Okay, that's Michael. That you'll have to come back for another sugya. Anyway, so how do we get out of this problem? So we have two more minutes. So we have a sefer Masechta Gittin called the Get Poshut. Haget Koshut Dambazer Umaskenoso He. Shalafirav Asi, Uman Kona Bishvach Kli, Vasofer Kona Bishvach Haget Ayide Ksivaso. Right? The Ainze Doma Litzaba, that if the Balabais owns the Samamonim, then there's no Uman Kona Bishvach. Dafka Bitzaba, and here I think he's quoting the Rash, but Sheino Osa Maisa Godel, Nechshav Ikra Shvach. Again, he's addressing your question. I'm not telling you I understand his answer, but somehow the shvach is through the samamonim, not through the action of the tzaba, and therefore, since the balabais owns the samamonim, he owns the shvach. Masha enkin besofer ha maiseshu osa hu maise gadol v'choshu dahinu ksivas ha sofer vareze doma leuman amesakin kli meaning from etzim shashvach. Who shall ha'uman is kosher? V'chein hiksha pnei Yoshua begin daf chof eich cotton kosher l'ksivas get l'fi ha get poshut kevan she'uman kodesh le'harei al yidei ksivoso kona hu eshvach ha'get u'lahaknos es ha'get labal eino yochol kimbevur b'msech t'suk daf mem vav she'ena cotton yochol lahaknos. And this Pnei Yoshua is quoted by the Pischei Tshuva in Hilchas, in Ebed Ezra Hilchas Gittin. He's mochiach hapischei tshuva she hapnei Yoshua sover that. Just 1 second, right? Kedas hanesivus. Okay, there are a lot of different names here. I'm trying to just summarize. And what's the answer to the pnei Yeshua's kasha the nesivus? He says shahadyo shel habal. She'im adyo shel habal. Ein asofer kona al yidei ksivos of b'shvach haget. Right? The nesivus is. I'm sorry. The nesivus is clarifying the assumption, the premise of the pnei Yeshua's kasha. And what is the premise of the pnei Yeshua's kasha? That even if the diyo belongs to the baal, nevertheless, we still apply uvin kodesh shakli, and the pnei Yeshua himself doesn't offer this answer, but l'chora he's going to have to answer that for some reason, which I don't know why, if the Baal owns the Dio, then the Baal owns the get. We don't apply Uman Kovin Shachli, and it's like the case of the Baal who owns the summer month. Okay. That's one possibility. What's the other possibility? The other possibility is Rav Shimon Shkop. Says Rav Shimon Shkop, my father missed him by 1 year because he was in the yeshiva for 1 year. Yeah, then my father came the year after. I mean, my father was there already, but he was too young to go into Rav Shimon's shir. They wouldn't let him in. Oh, okay. So Rav Shimon wants to say that the Iker Kli belongs to the Baal HaBayis, and that's enough of a kinyan in get. Do you remember we spoke about the fact that there are two dimensions to the partnership of the Uman and the Baal HaBayis? So he wants to say that the Baal HaBayis has the goof, and the sofer owns the shvach, and the ownership of the Baal HaBayis on the goof hadavar is sufficient. Again, you have to be a bucket hill that's getting for this to establish that he can give the gift.
That's it.
Okay. So both I maybe on Thursday I'll finish up a little bit of this, but we do want to go fight in the
about tangible and intangible assets.
Right. Very good.